Yes, and you've got exactly the right group of people to be concerned about that. That is, the members of Congress and members of the Senate. What power do they have to pass laws and regulate? You know, when Arlen Specter talks about this, he seems personally insulted that the court has, you know, in
actually,
the past
they all do. It's probably the one thing that the members of this committee probably agree on, that they've passed laws, the Violence Against Women Act, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and they thought they considered the interests of the states, for example, and that they had made a record about that, and then comes back the Supreme Court and says, oh, that's unconstitutional as applied
to
the
states. Did
you
notice Mike DeWine, a fairly conservative Republican, brought it up, but the Congress passed the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the Supreme Court turned around and said, no, you can't enforce that against all state employees and hospital workers. And even a guy like Mike DeWine was sort of very offended by a decision like that.
And then, of course, there is what I think Senator Biden might have referred to as one of the elephants in the room, and that is the issue of abortion, certain to be the subject of the first set of questions tomorrow morning from Senator Specter.
Yes, and of course, the nominee has an extensive written record in this regard. He, first of all, it's in sort of chronological order. When he served in the Solicitor General's office, he helped write a brief arguing that Roe should be reversed. Now, one should say, one could easily say, well, that's your job. When you work in an administration, whether you're a political appointee or a non-political appointee, the administration makes the choice of what position it's going to take, and you carry it out. However, he volunteered for that task. He was not assigned it. He volunteered to help the guy who was assigned. And he then, shortly thereafter, applied for a job as Deputy Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Counsel. And one of the things he said in his application was that he was very proud of his role in seeking to reverse Roe versus Wade, and that he did not think the Constitution included a right to an abortion. So he's out there. And then when the Supreme Court reaffirmed the central right of what the court called the core holding of Roe in 1992, it reversed a decision that he had participated in from the Third Circuit Court of Appeals that had struck down, that had upheld a husband's right to veto a wife's abortion.
David? I was going to say, I think it would be really fascinating if he would actually talk with some candor about Roe versus Wade and his view of it. We've almost never had that. You know, all the nominees sort of walk away from it and say that, you know, that's something I can't really discuss. But I think it would almost be smart for him. If you've written memos and said there is no constitutional right to abortion and it should be reversed, he ought to say something about his view of Roe versus Wade. Then I think surely we can expect he'll talk a lot about precedent. He'll say, even if I thought that then, it's a precedent now, and therefore...
But the reason, David, he probably won't do that is that then the very strong right to life advocates on this committee, Sam Brownback, Senator Coburn of Oklahoma, who threatened even at the Roberts hearings at one point to vote against him because they thought maybe he was being too deferential to precedent, that they would bolt and vote against Alito. And that this administration doesn't want either.
But I guess I don't understand why you can't sort of talk honestly and say, I actually was, I must admit it, Senators, I was troubled by the Roe versus Wade decision in the 70s. In the 80s, I still thought the Supreme Court got it wrong. But over the years, it's become embedded. It was reaffirmed by the Supreme Court in 1992, and it's a different matter today. But they're not even willing to discuss the first part. We all know a smart guy like Sam Alito has thought about Roe versus Wade and has an opinion on it, had some view of it. I think it'd be interesting and fascinating if he's willing to discuss a little bit of his own thinking about that issue from the past.
It's interesting, you know, that other Supreme Court justice nominees, they talk about the Ginsburg precedent. And in fact, she refused to discuss her views of the death penalty, her legal views mm-hmm. about the death penalty, saying she'd never written about it, talked about it, handled a death penalty case, and she wasn't going to commit herself. Now, in contrast to that, for example, Justice Breyer, nominee Breyer, said he thought that the death penalty was constitutional, that was settled law, meaning I don't care what my views were about it, it's settled. And he said the same thing about abortion, but he said he couldn't comment about specifics like what certain restrictions, because they might come before the court. Similarly, Justice Ginsburg, who had written extensively about abortion, talked quite openly and candidly about her view that, as she put it, decisions involving autonomy, personal autonomy, were protected by the Constitution.
Those issues, we will be hearing questions on workers' rights, on racial discrimination, on the rights of women broadly, on the division between church and state, all issues that I think are trying to get to a fundamental political question. We know that Samuel Alito is a conservative. Is he what's being described by his supporters as a mainstream conservative? Is he, as he is being described by his critics, as someone who is on the far right, on the extreme, and on this this hearing may rise or fall?
Of course, what was the extreme or out of the mainstream 15 years ago may not be today. We've had long periods of Republican appointive rule for the lower courts anyway, and those courts are now heavily dominated. I think all but two have Republican appointee majorities. And so what was the same is to some extent true if you look at the period from the Reagan administration on of the Supreme Court. Although conservatives are most displeased about the Supreme Court, they think it's too liberal. The fact of the matter is that Justice John Paul Stevens, nominated by President Ford to the court, and who was considered a sort of moderate conservative when he was appointed, is now perhaps the most liberal member of the court. And that is in large part due because the center of gravity has changed on the court.
David Savage, the stakes of this, many of the senators who've spoken already today have pointed out that Samuel Alito would be replacing Sandra Day O'Connor, the person who has been the deciding vote in many 5-4 decisions, someone who could shift the ideological bend of the Supreme Court. And that, of course, is a hugely important subtext to all of this. Liberals alarmed at this prospect, conservatives overjoyed.
Yes, Nina and I have been covering the court for a long time, and there are a lot of times when we go upstairs to hear a pretty big case, and we all say, well, this is going to depend on Justice O'Connor. It's pretty clear how four on the left think and four on the right, and Justice O'Connor was going to be the person who was going to decide the case and sort of set the law. And so anybody who comes into that position, you want to know, is this a person who's a moderate conservative, or is this a person who has a very strong conservative ideology that on all the big issues he's going to lean right? And I don't think we know the answer to that. I hope we learn a little bit.
No, I don't think we do. Here's Senator Specter.
These hearings.
Senator Specter is in his chair. None of the other senators are as yet. Senator Specter's been looking meaningfully
Next
at his watch.
Next up on questioning is Senator Graham.
Senator Graham is underneath us. I couldn't see him. Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina.
But rather next up on opening statement is Senator Graham.
And he has just taken his chair now. The nominee is not in his chair.
Okay.
So perhaps we'll wait for that. Senators are in a...
We should say that there have been reports that Senator Graham was doing some of the moot courting with administration lawyers of this nominee. And the question, of course, is now raised by some of the nomination's critics. How can Senator Graham be an independent voice on this when he's already been part of the prep sessions?
Senators beginning to take their seats at the sort of U-shaped table in the front of this hearing room in the Hart Senate office building. It's draped in, I guess that's maroon. I'll settle for that. Mm-hmm. And it's set upon a raised platform. There's a well beneath it. That's where the photographers gather. If you're watching this on television or seeing pictures in the newspaper tomorrow, you will not see the photographers who crowd underneath it, nor the clocks that tell the senators how much time is remaining in their session. There's a small table set in the middle of the well with one chair. That's where nominee Samuel Alito sits with one microphone in front of him. He's coming to that chair.
Senator Graham,
now.
You may begin.
And here's Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina.
Chairman, and welcome back, Judge. I'd hate for you to miss my opening statement. It would be a loss for the ages. Welcome to the committee. Welcome to one of the most important events in your life. You've got the people that mean the most here with you today, your family, and I know they're proud of you, and I'm certainly proud of what you've been able to accomplish. And to say the least, you come to the Senate in interesting political times. There's going to be a lot of talk by the senators of this committee about concepts that are important to Americans. But what I worry the most about, your time, believe it or not, will come and go. You will not be here forever. It may seem that way. But I think you're going to be just fine. I don't know what kind of vote you're going to get, but you'll make it through. It's possible you could talk me out of voting for you, but I doubt it. So I won't even try to challenge you along those lines. I feel very comfortable with you being on the Supreme Court based on what I know. And the hearings will be helpful to all of us to find out some issues that are important to us. We had a talk recently about executive power. That's very important to me. In a time of war, I want the executive branch to have the tools to protect me, my family, and my country. But also, I believe even during a time of war, the rule of law applies. And I've got some problems with using a force resolution to the point that future presidents may not be able to get a force resolution from Congress if you interpret it too broadly. And we've talked about those things, and we'll talk more about it. But I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the points my colleagues have been making. Everybody knows you're a conservative. The question is, are you a mainstream conservative? Well, the question I have for my colleagues is, who would you ask to find out? Would you ask Senator Kennedy? Probably not. If you ask me who a mainstream liberal is, I'd be your worst person to pick because I don't hang out over there. I expect that most all of us, if not all of us, will vote for you. And I would argue that we represent from the center line to the right ditch in our party. And if all of us vote for you, you got to be pretty mainstream. So the answer to your question, are you a mainstream conservative, will soon be known. If every Republican member of the Judiciary Committee votes for you and you're not mainstream, that means we're not mainstream. And it's a word that means what you want it to mean. Advice and consent means what? Whatever you want it to be. Advice and consent means the process has got to work to the advantage of people I like. And with people I don't want on the court, it's a different process. That's politics. Every senator will have to live within themselves as to what they would like to see happen for the judiciary. My main concern here is not about you, it's about us. What are we going to be doing as a body to the judiciary when it's all said and done? Roe v. Wade and abortion. If I wanted to work for Ronald Reagan, one of the things I would tell the Reagan administration is I think Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided. They're likely to hire me because they were trying to prove to the court that the court took away from elected officials a very important right, protecting the unborn. I was on a news program with Senator Feinstein this weekend, who is a terrific person. She made a very emotional, compelling argument that she can remember back alley abortions and women committing suicide when abortion was illegal. I understand that's very seared in her memory banks, and that's important to her. Well, let me tell you, there's another side to that story. There are millions of Americans, a bunch of them in South Carolina, who are heart sick that millions of unborn children have been sent to certain death because of what judges have done. It's a two-sided argument. It's an emotional event in our society. They're talking about filibustering maybe if you don't give the right answer. Well, what could possibly be the right answer about Roe v. Wade? If you acknowledge it's a precedent of the court, well, then you would be right. If you refuse to listen to someone who's trying to change the way it's applied or to overturn it, and you'll say, here, I will never listen to them, you might talk me out of voting for you. I don't think any American should lose the right to challenge any precedent that the Supreme Court has issued because the judge wanted to get on the court. And you may be a great fan of Roe v. Wade, and you think it should be there forever. There may be a case where someone disagrees with that line of reasoning. What I want from the judge is understanding that precedent matters, but the facts, the brief, and the law is what you're going to base your decision on as to whether or not that precedent stands, not some bargain to get on the court. Because I can tell you, if that ever becomes a reason to filibuster, there are plenty of people that I personally know, if it became fashionable to stand on the floor of the Senate to stop a nominee on the issue of abortion, feel so deeply, so honestly held belief that an abortion certain death for an unborn child, that they would stand on their feet forever. And is that what we want? Is that where we're going as a nation? Or are we going to take one case and one issue, and if we don't get the answer we like that represents our political view on that issue, are we going to bring the judiciary to their knees? Are we going to say as a body, it doesn't matter how smart you are, how many cases you've decided, how many things you've done in your life as a lawyer, forget about it. It all comes down to this one issue. If we do, if we go down that road, there will be no going back. And good men and women will be deterred from coming before this body to serve their nation as a judge at the highest levels. What we're saying and what we're doing here is far more important than just whether or not Judge Alito gets through the process. What is the proper role of a senator when it comes to advising and consenting? I would argue that if we start taking the one or two cases we cherish the most and make that a litmus test, that we've let our country down and we've changed a historical standard. Elections matter. Values debate occurs all over this country. They occur in presidential elections. It is no mystery as to what President Bush would do if he won. He would pick people like John Roberts and Sam Alito. That's what he said he would do. That's exactly what he's done. He's picked solid, strict constructionist conservatives with long, distinguished legal careers. What did President Clinton do? He picked people left of the center who work for Democrats. It cannot surprise anybody on the other side that two people we pick work for Ronald Reagan. We like Ronald Reagan. President Clinton picked Ginsburg and Breyer. Justice Ginsburg was the general counsel for the ACLU. If I'm going to base my decision based on who you represented as a lawyer, how in the world could I ever vote for somebody that represented the ACLU? If I'm going to make my decision based on whether or not I agree with the Princeton faculty and administration policies on ROTC students and quotas, and I'm bound by that, I'll get killed at home. What Princeton does with their admission policies and whether or not an ROTC unit should be on a campus is an okay thing to debate. At least I hope it's okay. And I think most Americans are going to be with a group that you're associated with, not the policies of Princeton. The bottom line is you come here as an individual with a life well lived. Everybody who seems to work with you as a private lawyer, public lawyer, as a judge admires you even though they may disagree with you. My biggest concern, members of this committee, is if we don't watch the way we treat people like Judge Alito, we're going to drive good men and women away from wanting to serve. There'll be a Democratic president one day. I don't know when, but that's likely to happen. And there'll be another judge, Justice Ginsburg, come over. If she came over in this atmosphere, she wouldn't get 96 votes. Judge Scalia wouldn't get 98 votes. And that's sad to me. I hope we'll use this opportunity to not only treat you fairly, but not use a double standard. I hope we'll understand that this is bigger than you. This is bigger than us. And the way we conduct ourselves and what we expect of you, we better be willing to expect when we're not in power. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Graham. Senator Schumer.
Charles Schumer, Democrat of New York.
Judge Alito, welcome to you, Mrs. Alito, your two children, the rest of your family. I join my colleagues in congratulating you on your nomination. If confirmed, you'll be one of nine people who collectively hold power over everyone who lives in this country. You'll define our freedom, you'll defect our security, and you'll shape our law. You will determine on some days where we pray and how we vote. You'll define on other days when life begins and what our schools may teach. and you will decide from time to time who shall live and who shall die. These decisions are final and appeals impossible. That's the awesome responsibility and power of a Supreme Court justice, and it's therefore only appropriate that everyone who aspires to that office bear a heavy burden when they come before the Senate and the American people to prove that they're worthy. But while every Supreme Court nominee has a great burden, yours, Judge Alito, is triply high. First, because you've been named to replace Sandra Day O'Connor, the pivotal swing vote on a divided court. Second, because you seem to have been picked to placate the extreme right wing after the hasty withdrawal of Harriet Myers. And finally, and most importantly, because your record of opinions and statements on a number of critical constitutional questions seems quite extreme. So first, as this committee takes up your nomination, we can't forget recent history, because that history increases your burden and explains why the American people want us to examine every portion of your record with great care. Harriet Myers' nomination was blocked by a cadre of conservative critics who undermined her at every turn. She didn't get to explain her judicial philosophy, she didn't get to testify at the hearing, and she did not get the up or down vote on the Senate floor that her critics are now demanding that you receive. Why? For the simple reason that those critics couldn't be sure that her judicial philosophy squared with their extreme political agenda. They seem to be very sure of you. The same critics who called the president on the carpet for naming Harriet Myers have rolled out the red carpet for you, Judge Alito. We'd be remiss if we didn't explore why. And there's an additional significance to the Myers precedent, which is this. Everyone now seems to agree that nominees should explain their judicial philosophy and ideology. After so many of my friends across the aisle spoke so loudly about the obligation of nominees to testify candidly about their legal views and their judicial philosophy when the nominee was Harriet Myers, I hope we will not see a flip-flop now that the nominee is Sam Alito. The second reason your burden is higher, of course, is that you're filling the shoes of Sandra Day O'Connor. Those are big shoes, to be sure. But hers are also special shoes. She was the first woman in the history of the Supreme Court, on the history of the Supreme Court, is the only sitting justice with experience as a legislator, and has been the most frequent swing vote in a quarter century of service. While Sandra Day O'Connor has been at the fulcrum of the court, you appear poised to add weight to one side. That alone is not necessarily cause for alarm or surprise, but is certainly a reason for pause. Are you in Justice O'Connor's mold? Or, as the president has vowed, are you in the mold of Justices Scalia and Thomas? Most importantly, though, your burden is high because of your record. Although I haven't made up my mind, I have serious concerns about that record. There are reasons to be troubled. You're the most prolific dissenter in the Third Circuit. This morning, President Bush said Judge Alito has the intellect and judicial temperament to be on the court. But the president left out the most important qualification, a nominee's judicial philosophy. Judge Alito, in case after case, you give the impression of applying careful legal reasoning, but too many times you happen to reach the most conservative result. Judge Alito, you give the impression of being a meticulous legal navigator, but in the end, you always seem to chart a rightward course. Some wrongly suggest that we're being results-oriented when we question the results you have reached, but the opposite is true. We're trying to make sure you're capable of being fair no matter the identity of the party before you. Sometimes you give the government a free pass, but refuse to give plaintiffs a fair shake. We need to know that presidents and paupers will receive equal justice in your courtroom. If the record showed that an umpire repeatedly called 95% of pitches strikes when one team's players were up, and repeatedly called 95% of pitches balls when the other team's players were up, one would naturally ask whether the umpire was being impartial and fair. In many areas, we'll expect clear and straightforward answers because you have a record on these issues. For example, executive power, congressional power, and personal autonomy, just to name a few. The president is not a king, free to take any action he chooses without limitation by law. The court is not a legislature, free to substitute its own judgment for that of elected bodies. And the people are not subjects, powerless to control their own most intimate decisions. Will your judicial philosophy preserve these principles, or will it erode them? In each of these areas, there's cause for concern. In the area of executive power, Judge Alito, you have embraced and endorsed the theory of the unitary executive. Your deferential and absolutist view of separation of powers raises questions. Under this view, in times of war, the president would, for instance, seem to have inherent authority to wiretap American citizens without a warrant, to ignore congressional acts at will, or to take any other action he saw fit under his inherent powers. We need to know, when a president goes too far, will you be a check on his power, or will you issue him a blank check to exercise whatever power alone he thinks appropriate? Right now, that is an open question, given your stated views. Similarly, on the issue of federalism, you seem to have taken an extreme view, substituting your own judgment for that of the legislature. Certainly, in one important case, you wrote in Rybar versus U.S. that Congress exceeded its power by prohibiting the possession of fully automatic machine guns. Do you still hold these cramped views of congressional power? Will you engage in judicial activism to find ways to strike down laws that the American people want their elected representatives to pass and that the Constitution authorizes? And of course, you've made statements expressing your view that the, quote, Constitution does not protect a right to an abortion, unquote. In fact, you said in 1985 that you personally believe very strongly this is true. You also spoke while in the Justice Department of, quote, the opportunity to advance the goals of bringing about the eventual overruling of Roe v. Wade. It should not be surprising that these statements will bring a searching inquiry, as many of my colleagues have already suggested. So we'll ask you, do you still personally believe very strongly that the Constitution does not protect a right to an abortion? We will ask, do you view elevation to the Supreme Court, where you'll no longer be bound by high court precedent, as the long-sought opportunity to advance the goals of bringing about the eventual overruling of Roe v. Wade, as you stated in 1985? Judge Alito, I sincerely hope you'll answer our questions. Most of the familiar arguments for ducking direct questions no longer apply and certainly don't apply in your case. For example, the logic of the mantra repeated by John Roberts at his hearing, that one could not speak on a subject because the issue was likely to come before him, quickly vanishes when the nominee has a written record, as you do, on so many subjects. Even under the so-called Ginsburg precedent, which was endorsed by Judge Roberts, Republican senators, the White House, you have an obligation to answer questions on topics that you have written about. On the issue of choice, for example, because you've already made blanket statements about your view of the Constitution and your support for overruling Roe, you've already given the suggestion of prejudgment on a question that will likely come before the court. So I respectfully submit you cannot use that as a basis for not answering. So I hope, Judge Alito, that when we ask you about prior statements you've made about the law, some strong, some even strident, you will simply not answer, in effect, no comment. That will not dismiss prior expressions of decidedly legal opinions as merely personal beliefs, and that will enhance neither your credibility nor your reputation for careful legal reasoning. I look forward, Judge, to a full and fair hearing.
Thank you, Senator Schumer. Senator Cornyn.
John Cornyn, Republican of Texas.
Judge Alito, welcome to the committee and to your family as well. I'm a little surprised to learn that you have a triply high burden for confirmation here. I guess we'll get a chance to explore that and the fairness of that, or whether all nominees ought to have the same burden before the committee. What I want to also make sure of is that we don't hold you to a double standard, that we don't expect of you answers to questions that Justice Ginsburg and others declined to answer in the interests of the independence of the judiciary and in the interests of observing the canons of judicial ethics. Nevertheless, we've already heard a great deal about you and your credentials for the Supreme Court. As has been noted, you serve with distinction on the Court of Appeals. You've served as a United States Attorney, and indeed you've served your entire adult life in public service. We've also heard a bit today, and we'll hear more as these proceedings unfold, about the testimonials from people who have worked with you, people who know you best, whether liberal, moderate, or conservative. The judges on your court have praised you as a thoughtful and open-minded jurist, and we'll hear more from them later in the week. The same as can be said of the law clerks who've worked with you over the last 15 years. As you know, law clerks are those who advise appellate judges and on the cases they hear, and you've had law clerks from all political persuasions, from members of the Green Party to Democrat clerks, even a clerk that went on to serve as counsel of record for John Kerry's campaign for president. And every single one of them says that you will make a terrific Supreme Court justice, that you apply the law in a fair and even-handed manner, and that you bring no agenda to your job as a judge. If fairness, integrity, qualifications, an open mind were all that mattered in this process, you would be confirmed unanimously. But we know that's not how the process works, or at least how it works today. We know that 22 senators, including five on this committee, voted against Chief Justice Roberts' confirmation just a few short months ago. And my suspicion is that you do not come here with a total level playing field. I'm reluctantly inclined to the view that you and other nominees of this president to the Supreme Court start with no more than 13 votes on this committee and only 78 votes in the full Senate, with a solid, immovable, unpersuadable block of at least 22 votes against you, no matter what you say and no matter what you do. Now, that's unfortunate for you, but it's even worse for the Senate and its reputation as the world's greatest deliberative body. The question is why, with so many people from both sides of the aisle and across the ideological spectrum supporting your nomination, are liberal special interest groups and their allies devoting so much time and so much money to defeat your nomination? The answer, I'm afraid, is that there are a number of groups who really don't want a fair-minded judge who has an openness to both sides of the argument. Rather, they want judges who will impose their liberal agenda on the American people, views so liberal that they cannot prevail at the ballot box. So they want judges who will find traditional marriage limited to one man and one woman unconstitutional. They want judges who will ban any religious expression from the public square. They even want judges who will prohibit school children from reciting the Pledge of Allegiance. As I say, none of these are mainstream positions embraced by the American people, so the strategy is to try to impose their agenda through unelected judges. Judge Alito, the reason why these groups are trying to defeat your nomination, because you won't support their liberal agenda, is precisely why I support it. I want judges on the Supreme Court who will not use that position to impose their personal policy preferences or a political agenda on the American people. I want judges on the Supreme Court who will respect the words and the meaning of the Constitution, the laws enacted by Congress and the laws enacted by state legislatures. Now, this doesn't mean, as you know, that a judge will always reach what might be called a conservative result. It means that judges will reach whatever result is directed by the Constitution, by the law, and by the facts of the case. Sometimes it might be called conservative, sometimes it might be called liberal. But the point is that the meaning of the Constitution and other laws should not change unless we, the people, change them. A Supreme Court nomination and appointment is not a roving commission to rewrite our laws however you and your colleagues see fit. I'll give you one example where I believe our Supreme Court has been rewriting the law for a long time. It's an area near and dear to me and others in this country, and I'm speaking of the ability of people of faith to freely express their beliefs in the public square. There's no doubt where the Founding Fathers stood on this issue. They believe that people of faith should be permitted to express themselves in public. They believe that this country was big enough and free enough to allow expression of an enormous variety of views and beliefs. They believe that freedom of expression included religious views and beliefs, so long as the government did not force people to worship in a particular manner and remain neutral on what those views and beliefs were. But this country has gotten seriously off track under the Supreme Court when it went so far as to limit the right of even private citizens to freely express their religious views in public. As I mentioned to you when we met early on in these proceedings, I had an opportunity, as some have had on this committee, to argue a case before the United States Supreme Court. When I was Attorney General, I argued a case, helped argue a case called Santa Fe Independent School District versus Doe. The school district in that case had the temerity to permit student-led, student-initiated prayer before football games. And, of course, someone sued. I repeat, this was student-led, student-initiated, voluntary prayer. The Supreme Court held by a vote of 6-3 that this was unconstitutional. The decision led the late Chief Justice Rehnquist to remark that the court now, quote, exhibits hostility to all things religious in public life. And it's hard to disagree with him. Depictions or expressions of sex, violence, crime are all permitted virtually without limit. But religion, it seems, never. Now, this is where you come in, Judge. I appreciate your record on the Third Circuit respecting the importance of neutrality of government when it comes to religious expression on a voluntary basis by individual citizens. It's my sincere hope that, when confirmed, that you will persuade your colleagues to reconsider their attitude toward religious expression and grant it the same freedom currently reserved for almost all other non-religious speech. No wonder many in America seem to believe that the court has become one more inclined to protect pornography than to protect religious expression. Most people in America don't believe that God is a dirty word. But the sad fact is that some Americans are left to wonder whether the Supreme Court might have greater regard for it if it was. Again, welcome to the committee, and thank you for your continued willingness to serve our great nation.
Thank you, Senator Cornyn. Senator Durbin.
Richard Durbin, Democrat of Illinois.
Judge Alito, welcome to you and your family before the Judiciary Committee. You've heard time and again from my colleagues why this seat on the Supreme Court means so much. They quoted the statistics of 193 5-4 decisions where Sandra Day O'Connor was the deciding vote in 148 of those instances. She was a critical vote in issues of civil rights, human rights, workers' rights, women's rights, restraining the power of an overreaching president. If you look at the record and the enviable record which Sandra Day O'Connor has written, you find she was the fifth and decisive vote to safeguard Americans' right to privacy, to require our courtrooms to grant access to the disabled, to allow the federal government to pass laws to protect the environment, to preserve the right of universities to use affirmative action, to ban the execution of children in America. And Justice O'Connor was the fifth vote to uphold the time-honored principle, which bears repeating, of separation of church and state. There was real wisdom in the decision of our forefathers in writing a constitution that gave us an opportunity to grow as such a diverse nation, and we should never forget it. Justice O'Connor has been the critical, decisive vote on many issues that go to the heart of who we are as a nation. We believe, many of us, that the decision on filling this vacancy is going to tip the scales of justice on the Supreme Court one way or the other. And that's why we are so mindful of the importance of our task. Yesterday, the Chicago Tribune editorialized that anyone who questions your nomination has a heavy burden of proof. I disagree. I believe the burden of proof is yours, Judge Alito. The burden of demonstrating to the American people and this committee that you or any nominee is worthy to serve on the highest court to succeed Sandra Day O'Connor. My friend, Illinois Senator Paul Simon, once said on the same committee that the test for a Supreme Court nominee is not where he stands on any given issue. The test is this: will you use your power on the court to restrict freedom or expand it? In the simplest terms, I think Paul Simon got it right. That is the best test, because the Supreme Court is the last refuge in America for our rights and liberties. In my lifetime, it's the Supreme Court, not Congress, that integrated public schools, that allowed people of different races to marry, and established the principle that our government should respect the value of privacy of American families. These decisions are the legacy of justices who chose to expand American freedom. If you're confirmed, Judge Alito, will you continue their legacy? You and I spoke about the Griswold decision in my office. Hard to imagine, 40 years ago, people could be convicted of a crime, fined, sent to prison for using the most common forms of birth control. The Supreme Court looked at that decision, looked at that case, and said, that's just wrong. We may not find the word privacy in the Constitution, but that's just inherent to our freedom as Americans. It seems like a given now. Who would even question it? But it hasn't been that long ago that up here on Capitol Hill, we were involved in a bitter debate over the tragedy of Terri Schiavo. And Republican congressional leaders threatened federal judges with impeachment if they didn't agree to intervene into that family's painful personal decision. We see it in attempts on Capitol Hill to impose gag rules on doctors on what they can say to their patients about family planning. And we certainly see it now with an effort by this government to tap our phones, invade our medical records, credit information, library records, and the most sensitive personal information in the name of national security. Now, Justice O'Connor was the critical fifth vote to protect our right of privacy. We want to know whether you will be that vote as well. You were the only judge on your court to authorize a very intrusive search of a 10-year-old girl. You were the only judge on your court who voted to diminish the right of privacy in the case of Planned Parenthood versus Casey, a position that was specifically rejected by the Supreme Court. And as a government lawyer, you wrote that you personally believe very strongly the Constitution does not protect the right to an abortion. Like many, I have thought about this issue of abortion time and again. It is not an easy issue for most people. I've thought about the law, the impact of my personal religious beliefs and feelings. I've thought about the real lives of people and the tragic experiences of the women that I've met. And I've came to believe over the years that a woman should be able to make this agonizing decision with her doctor and her family and her conscience, and that we should be very careful that we don't make that decision a crime except in the most extreme circumstances. There's also the issue of personal privacy when it comes to the executive power. Throughout our nation's history, during times of war, whether it was habeas corpus in the Civil War, Alien and Sedition Acts in World War I, or Japanese internment camps in World War II, presidents have gone too far. And in going too far, they have taken away the individual rights of American citizens. The last stop to protect those rights and liberties is the Supreme Court. That's why we want to make certain that when it comes to the checks and balances of the Constitution, that you will stand with our founding fathers in protecting us from a government or a president determined to seize too much power in the name of national security. As a government lawyer, you pushed a policy of legislative construction designed to make congressional intent secondary to presidential intent. You wrote, and I quote, "The president will get in the last words on questions of interpretation," close quote. In speeches to the Federalist Society, you've identified yourself as a strong proponent of the so-called unitary executive theory. That's a marginal theory at best, and yet it's one that you've said you believe. This is not an abstract debate. The Bush administration has repeatedly cited this theory to justify its most controversial policies in the war on terrorism. Under this theory, the Bush administration has claimed the right to seize American citizens in the United States and imprison them indefinitely without a charge. They've claimed this right to engage in torture, even though American law makes torture a crime. Less than 2 weeks ago, the White House claimed the right to set aside the McCain Torture Amendment that passed the Senate 90-9. What was the rationale? The unitary executive theory, which you've spoken of. In the Hamdi case, Justice O'Connor wrote for the plurality, and it's been quoted many times, A state of war is not a blank check for the president when it comes to the rights of the nation's citizens. If you're confirmed, Judge Alito, who will inspire your thinking if this president or any president threatens our fundamental constitutional rights? Will it be the Federalist Society or will it be Sandra Day O'Connor? 2 months ago, Rosa Parks was laid to rest. Her body lies in state in the Capitol Rotunda, a fitting tribute to the mother of our modern civil rights movement. Her courage is well known. The courage of Federal Judge Frank Johnson, whom we talked about, is well known as well. He was the one that gave the legal authority for the right to march from Selma to Montgomery, and he suffered dearly for it. He was ostracized and rejected. His life was threatened as a result of it. When we met in our office, Judge Alito, you told me about how your father, as a college student, was almost expelled for standing up to the college president who decided that the school basketball team should not use its African-American players against an all-white opponent. That university president didn't want to offend their all-white opponent, but your dad stood up, and you were so proud of that moment in your family history. I admire your father's courage as well. But just as we do not hold the son responsible for the sins of the father, neither can we credit the son for the courage of the father. As Supreme Court Justice, would you have the courage to stand up for civil rights, even if it's unpopular? We want to understand what you meant in 1985 when you said from the heart that you disagreed with the Warren Court on reapportionment, the one-man, one-vote decision. That was a civil rights decision. We want you to explain your membership in an organization that you highlighted at Princeton University that tried to challenge the admission of women and minorities. And I think we want to make certain of one thing. We want to make certain that every American who stood in silent tribute to Rosa Parks hopes that you will break your silence and speak out clearly for the civil rights that define our unity as a nation. There have been many controversial cases alluded to here. Some people have questioned, what's the difference? What difference in my life does it make if Sam Alito's on the bench or if he isn't? Why would I care if it's a narrow interpretation or a broad interpretation of the law? How does it affect my life? We know it affects everyone's life. We were reminded just very recently with a tragedy that was in the headlines. In one of your dissents, you would have allowed a Pennsylvania coal mine to escape worker safety and health requirements required by federal law. Last week's tragedy at the Sago mine reminds us that such a decision could have life and death consequences. Judge Alito, millions of Americans are concerned about your nomination. They're worried that you would be a judicial activist who would restrict our rights and freedoms. During your hearing, you'll have a chance to respond, and I hope you do. More than any recent nominee, your speeches, your writings, your judicial opinions make it clear that you have the burden to prove to the American people that you would not come to the Supreme Court with any political agenda. Clear and candid answers are all that we ask. I sincerely hope you can convince the United States Senate and the American people that you will be a fifth vote on the Supreme Court that the American people can trust, protect our most basic, important freedoms, and preserve our time-honored values. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Durbin. Senator Brownback.
Thank you, Mr.
Sam
Chairman.
Sam Brownback, Republican
Welcome
of Kansas.
Judge Alito, your wife, family, delighted to have you here. You only have two more pitchers, and then you get a bat. So we'll, I'm sure people will be happy to hear from you. Mr. Chairman, before I go forward with my statement, I would like to enter into the record a summary of four cases that Judge Alito has ruled on where he backed employees claiming racial discrimination. It's been entered a couple of times here that he hasn't ruled in favor of people claiming racial discrimination. And I have a summary of four cases where he has, and I want to enter that into the record.
Without objection, they will be made a part of the record.
Judge Alito, welcome you to the hearing. This is an extraordinary process. It's a fabulous process and a chance for a discussion with you, with the American public, about the role of the judiciary in our society today. It's become an ever-expanding and important discussion because of the expanding role of the courts in recent years in the American society. When the courts improperly, I believe, assume the power to decide more political than legal issues in nature, the people naturally focus less on the law and more on the lawyers that are chosen really to administer the law. Most Americans want judges who will stick to interpreting the law rather than making it. It's beyond dispute that the Constitution and its framers intended this to be the role of judges. For instance, although he was perhaps the leading advocate for expansive federal power, you can look at Founding Father Alexander Hamilton, nevertheless assuring the countrymen in Federalist 78 that the role of the federal courts under the proposed Constitution would be limited. He says the courts must declare the sense of the law, and if they should be disposed to exercise will instead of judgment, the consequences would equally be the substitution of their pleasure to that of the legislative body. It seems like we're back at an old debate, the role of the courts. And I believe you and others would look and say that the role of the courts is limited, and it's not to decide political matters. Chief Justice Marshall later explained in Marbury v. Madison, the Constitution permitted federal courts neither to write nor execute the laws, but rather to say what the law is. That narrow scope of judicial power was the reason the people accepted the idea that the federal courts could have the power of judicial review. That is the ability to decide whether a challenged law comports with the Constitution. The people believed that while the courts would be independent, they would defer to the political branches on policy issues. This is the most foundational and fundamental of issues. And yet we're back in discussing it because of the role of the judiciary expanding in this society today. It may seem ironic, but the judicial branch preserves its legitimacy through refraining from action on political questions. That concept was put forward best by Justice Frankfurter, appointed by President Roosevelt. He said, courts are not representative bodies. They're not designed to be a good reflex of a democratic society. Their judgment is best informed and therefore most dependable within narrow limits. Now, I want to take on this point of the reservation of certain seats on the bench for certain philosophies, which it seems as if we've heard a great deal about today, that you need to be like Sandra Day O'Connor in judicial philosophy to be able to go on her seat on the bench. And some interest groups have put forward that philosophy and argued that you deserve closer scrutiny because you don't appear to have the same philosophy or even opposition if it's not determined that you don't have that same judicial philosophy. If this testimony suggests that that would change the ideological balance, if you would change that ideological balance, therefore you shouldn't be approved. And I say that that notion is not anywhere in the understanding of the role of the judges. It creates a double standard for your approval and looks conveniently, it looks suspiciously convenient for the opposition to put forward. Seats on the bench are not reserved for causes or interest. They're given to those who will uphold the rule of law so long as the nominee is well qualified to interpret and apply the law. This has long been the case of the Supreme Court. And I want to note here that historically, the makeup of the court has changed just as elected branches have changed. In fact, nearly half of the justices, 46 of 109, who have served on the Supreme Court, replaced justices appointed by a different political party.